listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 526.
Hello and welcome back to the Outdoor Station with me, your host, Bob Cartwright. Struggling still through the challenges of remote internet connectivity from our rural base here in the heart of England in Worcestershire countryside. However, that said, we have had good days and bad days, and I'm glad to say that this is the first part of a two-part interview, and it was on a very, very good connectivity day. And not just any old good day, as I had the best fortune to spend a couple of hours in the company of Bethany Fidget Hughes and Lauren Neon Reed, who set out in November 2015 to travel by self-powered means the 20,000 miles from the tip of South America to the northernmost point of the Americas. If you check out their website, her-odyssey.org, you'll see that this isn't just a long-distance hike, but more an exploration of the land, new trails, of human relationships, of empowerment, and the understanding and sharing of cultures. You've listened to many of my interviews, I'm sure, and maybe you have your own definition of what a backpacking trip or through hike or long adventure should consist of, be it something which takes days, weeks, or even months. But when you start to measure it not by distance, but by time, 5 years so far in this case, maybe other factors need to be considered. Her Odyssey is a big subject to discuss, and we kicked around various angles via email in recent months to include. So far, they've completed 8,000 miles in South America, which took 730 days, through 6 countries and 20 pairs of shoes. COVID has obviously added various pressures halfway through an odyssey like this, and I hope you'll enjoy hearing some of the backstory as well as the detail which a self-funded, self-powered commitment of 20,000 miles like this requires. But first, an introduction from Bethany, or Fidget as she's probably better known, about the purpose, aim and motivation behind Her Odyssey.
The mission statement of Her Odyssey is a human-powered endeavor across the length of the Americas, connecting the story of the land and its inhabitants. It arose from my background of being brought up in South America and seeing the incongruities between labor and recognition of genders, as well as some of the cultural disparities between what I saw from my North American family and my South American community. And I wanted to come back to that as an adult and to see it through different eyes than what I saw as a kid. And one of the things that we've realized over the course of this journey has been that it's actually less to do with the specifics of what a person does, so much as the passion that they bring to what they do, which has the largest impact. And I happen to be really passionate about human-powered travel and showing up alongside my environment and my species. And this was a very appealing way to do that. And it was a way also to connect my own childhood of growing up scrambling in the Andes to my life as an adult in the working in the Rockies and in Alaska. So it's just a way to bridge a lot of narratives, which is another big part of Her Odyssey, is that it's a journey not only in the physical journey, but also in terms of the story and telling the stories of others and weaving those stories together into the tapestry that is our experience and the role that we play on this planet that we got lucky enough to land on.
So, Lauren, have you got a history of South America as well, as a younger person?
No, not at all. Bethany and I actually met on the Pacific Crest Trail, which is a 2,600-mile long route along the Pacific that goes through California, Oregon, and Washington in the U.S. And we met in 2010 hiking, and then I lived in Utah, and she lived in Colorado, and so we would see each other a lot. And she kept, basically, since she came up with this idea, she was talking about it. And every time I came and visited her, I'd like ask her some questions and she'd respond. And so it just like kept me thinking.
Drip feeding you, reeling you in slowly like a fish.
Yeah, exactly. And I recently actually learned that a lot of the answers that she gave me after I asked those questions were made up.
Oh, and you only found out when you're halfway through South America.
Basically, yeah. I think we were in like Ecuador, Colombia, when she was like, oh, yeah, I just made those up. And then they were really good questions. So I would go look them up afterwards and find the actual answers. But this was like years of hearing about it and learning some more about it. And I'd always wanted to go to South America and had a deep interest in it. But the opportunity hadn't presented itself until that time. And then in 2013, I did the Continental Divide Trail, which goes from Canada to Mexico through Colorado for a while. And Bethany actually helped me with my resupplies. So she would send out packages to me. And after that, I was just kind of like more and more interested in doing this longer journey. And then I think in early 2015 or late 2014 was when I like sat down with her and I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do this, but I'll only do South America.
Okay. So you're on the hook.
Yeah. And since then, it's obviously been adjusted and adapted just like anything else with this journey. And like now I'm very much committed to following through with the entire journey. But it's just funny because a lot of people are like, oh, you only committed to South America.
So let's give listeners perspective here. I know that you're both in your early 30s now. So when you first met, you obviously early 20s, I guess, when you were hiking. And I know that, Lauren, you're a triple crowner. So you've done the three trails, if we're very familiar with, if you like, in the UK. A lot of people aspire to do them or have done them, certainly. So looking at this as a project then, let's just initially talk about the preparation. Apart from the fact that she was selling it to you for 10 years, best part of, to drag you out there. Let's just talk about the finances side of it, because I know you've put on your website the sort of accounts from, I think, 2018-ish to give people an idea of some of the sacrifices that you have to make on something like this, because this is not a walk in the park in any shape of the imagination. I mean, aside from the physical part of it, you know, the finances and also the amount of time you're away from what would be normal life, I guess, for a lot of people. So just roughly give me an idea sort of the sacrifices both of you made to prepare for this.
From my end, from the moment that the calling came to me, it was a matter of rising to that challenge and to trust that what I needed to achieve that would also come into play in its own time. And for me, that has happened. I see the specific question of the finances and I will come to that, but that is one small piece of just this larger, like how Neon ended up or how Lauren ended up coming into this journey. Is I was just like, I knew that I needed someone to do it with me who thought differently than I did, who could help balance things, but also put up with me for so long in such a challenging environment. And those questions that she was asking, you know, I could guesstimate the answer for her, but I needed someone who, so in the same way as she came into the narrative and it was a comedy of errors that it worked out, you know, I had in my plans and my projections, I was going to be starting much earlier than she was ready to come onto it. But because I tore my ACL in a skiing accident, it delayed my plans, which ended up being perfect, because then it worked out such that she could come along. In the same way, the finances, I set out a very clear plan of how it was all, you know, I had my spreadsheets, and I did, you know, just some very old fashioned. It started with a little paper envelope, and I had given a talk at a local senior center. And by that, I mean a group of seniors who met at the Pizza Hut in town. And this older gentleman, when he was leaving, he walked by and he gave me $10. And I put that $10 in this little envelope, and I just wrote Big Adventure Fund, because I didn't even know what the name of this was going to be. I just knew that I was going to do it. So it started with cash in an envelope, and then I put that into savings. And then I worked for 5 years. I worked 4 different jobs, and I put between 10 and probably about 25% of each paycheck that I got into a savings exclusively for this journey. And then on top of that, tried to reduce the expenses of it by establishing partnerships with brands that put some ethics into creating and create the kind of gear that we need. We're pretty extreme gear testers. And then on top of that, even all of my best laid plans fell shy of what ended up needing to happen. And so over time, it has also been a matter of checking our ego and asking for the help that we need on something on platforms like Patreon, where we are now. So the finances have come together as a variety of pieces that arise when we need them.
And yourself, Lauren?
I have always lived pretty frugally. So I didn't quite save up as much money as Bethany did, but I was able to stow away quite a bit in the time that I needed to. And then, yeah, we've just had... I worked for a wilderness therapy program. So 16 days out of the month, I was out of service, not really able to spend money anyway. And so that really helped. And they feed you, and like, it's an 8-day on, 6-day off program for me. The kids stay out there all the time. But I would be 8 days in the field, and then I'd come out and take a shower and then go home for a few days and then come back. So I only had really 12 days a month to spend money.
Okay. So, I mean, you got together a fair amount of funds, and people can certainly look at the website for an indication of the sort of amounts you had. But I suppose what I'm getting to is, did you anticipate that the South America would be one long, complete, continuous route, run, as it were? Or were you going to break it up? Did you intend to break it up into sections due to the seasons and the weather and whatever as you went?
When I first envisioned this, it was a straight through. I would not leave the route in any way through the tenure of the duration of the journey. A variety of factors shifted that over time. The first was the realization that in order to see the project through, I would need to shift a lot of my expectations. One piece of it was I wanted it to be about community. And, you know, my sister was having a child and my grandmother died. And I kind of realized what a selfish narrative it would be to go out into the wider world and tell everyone how important it is to have connection when you're disregarding your own support system and your own family. And then another piece of it was realizing that to sustain the partnership that Lauren and I have, we need time apart from each other. And then seasons as well has been another one of the big ones. Like, you know, in the U.S., here in the United States, we're just so used to like winter, summer, but in the variety of areas we've gone through, it's not that clearly defined. In some areas, it's like there's the windy season and the rainy season, or there's the dry season and the wet season. So there's been a lot of adapting to that. Like right now, it's better that we're not in Central America because right now is hurricane season.
Okay. Well, let's get the listeners excited then and actually start talking about the trip itself. Thank you for sort of getting us a bit of an overview of how you have approached this. Now, what was it like getting down to the tip of South America, and how did you feel when you first got there?
Getting down there was a trip in and of itself because it's like a 10-hour flight to Santiago, and then you're like only halfway through Chile to get down to Tierra del Fuego. So it's another, what, eight-hour flight?
Mm-hmm.
It's
on a little plane.
Yeah. And so we ended up there, and like the mountains down on Tierra del Fuego, because we flew into Ushuaia, Argentina, to start, which is the southernmost city in the world. And it's on the southern end of Tierra del Fuego, which is actually a little bit further south than the southern end of the southern tip of South America, of the continent. So we started there, and to fly in there was like really crazy because they had just had a storm, like a snowstorm, the week before we flew there. And we had kind of been in contact with, again, like it continues to be the community, like a friend of a friend introduced us to a friend that lived down there. And so we had been in contact with her and like talking with her about what to expect, more on the ground information. And she was like, yeah, it snowed here last week. I don't know if you guys will be able to do what you want to do. And so we came down being like, no, we'll be fine. Like maybe they don't know what they're talking about. And then we flew in and like, you just see these giant mountains out the window. And I was just like, oh, maybe we won't be able to do what we wanted to do.
It was everything that I couldn't have expected and more. And there were these moments that I would have of her name was Coco and her daughter walking us around Ushuaia, trying to help us find pepper spray or fuel, like not canisters, but a certain kind of fuel that we needed for our stoves, and just the tenacity and the excitement that they had to be a part of it. And so even as I was literally watching and at each step learning that my physical plan of the route that I had intended through the Darwins was not going to play out, all of the elements around it and my reason for being there were being affirmed in every interaction with these women. And so it was both, it was like having the rug pulled out from under me. And being caught by people who you didn't even know were going to be there for you. So it's very frightening and really exciting at the same time.
There's a big moment, isn't there, when you have to let yourself trust a stranger or trust other people.
Mm-hmm. And the entire journey has been that.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing about long distance travel, and you go further afield and you go well and truly off the track. All of a sudden, trust becomes an element, becomes the seventh sense, I think.
Very much so. And I think that's one of the things, a particular component of like as women doing this that has been interesting, because we get a lot of questions of, aren't you afraid? And I mean, the answer is yes. And also, at least from my end, I was essentially trained to be afraid my entire life. And also in that you learn to trust that instinct and that read on people. And so there would be times when even from a great distance away, there would be a person and I would not want to go near them. And rather than like I would in my own environment, in a safe environment where I'd be like, well, come on, give that person a chance. In these environments, there's already such a high risk factor that if either of our instincts for any reason said, don't, we didn't. We would just try to avoid going into those situations altogether by listening to that voice, by checking in little hairs on the back of your neck that tingle. And we even like established a word that we would say to each other. And if the other one said that, no questions asked, you picked up your stuff and you walked out together And that has, I think that's one of the greatest things of like with dangers that we've faced is walking away from them before they became truly pressing issues.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The as you say, I suppose we are educated in the Western world to be in fear all the time. Not a terrified fear, but certainly always be cautious. There's always think of the negative. Whereas in actual fact, as I'm sure you're telling in your stories, that sometimes the people with the least give the most. And they're not people you'd normally turn to for help.
Almost every single time, that was the truth that we found. And that was one of the great advantages of walking into those situations is there are these expected power structures at play. And so when they see white people, the locals down there will assume a certain thing. But when you walk up to them and ask, do you have water? They suddenly hold almost all of the power in that moment and in that place, and that they know that terrain. And by flipping that narrative, it really helped to open up communication and a chance to commune, because we were exposed to the same elements as they were. Often we'd be walking alongside women who were walking their alpacas back or out to the field, women gathering water, washing laundry in the rivers, you know, so you put yourself by being willing to trust that, it really opens up a lot of opportunity for connection that would not happen if you did not look that fear in the face, say, yes, I see you, I hear you, and I will proceed.
I've watched a few of your videos, and I know you speak, good Spanish. Spanish, as far as I can, all sounds fantastic. What about you, Lauren? Are you fluent as well?
I wouldn't say that I'm fluent. I know sufficient Spanish to navigate. I probably know a lot more than most people who speak English do, unless they speak Spanish as like their first or second language.
You can engage with the locals quite easily, the pair of you, obviously. That was what I was trying to get to, yeah?
For sure, yeah. We definitely, and that's, I mean, Fidget is a huge community proponent, and so she'll just go up and start a conversation with anybody that she feels comfortable, especially like she was a teacher for a long time. So like watching and learning from that. And I've had people across the Americas ask me if it's more difficult to learn more Spanish with her because she's so proficient. And my response is usually like, I mean, I have somebody that I can ask to clarify different things. And like, she can correct me if I like make a mistake or like that kind of thing. So I think it's more useful. I'm also not much of a talker. So that's kind of on me that I haven't learned probably as much or as quickly as I could have.
But you can, yeah, I'm sure you hear a lot and you understand a lot, even though you can't necessarily sort of reiterate or reply, as it were.
One of the games that we really enjoyed playing is when we would meet people and they would tell us stories and I would not translate them to Neon and then, or to Lauren. And then we would walk and I'd be like, all right, what did you hear they said? Like, the man said that he was on a boat in the midst of a giant storm and the boat capsized and everyone went everywhere. And it's just the very Latin storytelling, the passion and the gestures. And I was like, well, actually it was that he took the ferry across the strait and it was pretty wavy waters, but also I can see why you thought that it was.
Well, I'm sure that passed a lot of time doing that to each other. Anyway, let's get back to the trip. So we've arrived at the southern tip there. Can you just describe what your surroundings were like? Are we talking sort of, well, if it had been a snowstorm, I presume, and obviously it's fairly green and pleasant land, is it?
It's very green and lush, but it also has this harshness to it because it is so far south. It's what, at 54 degrees south in latitude? And even though it was like spring, some of the flowers were like just coming out. But yeah, there's this harsh, and it's just like, especially a Tierra del Fuego is like, all of Patagonia is quite windy too. So there's just this like, I don't even know how to explain it, but it's like there's this harshness of like, oh, it could get really bitter cold here. I'm glad it's not. And then it's like partially cloudy, but yeah, a lot of greenery. And then there are these just mountains that kind of rise up almost out of the sea. And then they're covered in, what are those, the Cinco Hermanos?
Some of the mountains are called Cinco Hermanos, Mount Olivia. They're very jagged. They're very young mountains. And it's the only place where the Andes actually runs east to west. So it creates this particular weather pattern between the Beagle Channel and the mountains there, which run east to west, which cultivated for a long time many species of trees that did not exist. It was why Darwin was so fascinated going through there. And the Notofagus forest and these kind of trees that there's different kinds of them, ranging from shrubs to these massive old growth, and walking through where there had been old growth forests that were now just like cemeteries, just stumps, bleached white. And you're walking on these roads or these pathways that are made up of just the logs of those trees that have been cut down, laid sideways, because it's the only way you can get through, because otherwise the ground is so muddy. So it's like you're walking over the corpses of the trees that once held that land together. And then going through the valleys that are flooded because of the beavers that Canada sent down a couple pairs of beavers as gifts 50 years ago to try to help promote the industry down there. And now there's like 10,000 beavers, and they've cut down a bunch of the like ancient, like these, there were these trees we'd be climbing over that were taller, fallen over, trying to climb over them or trying to like wiggle underneath them with a backpack and like deep mud. And alternating between these what remains and the areas from which it has been cleared.
Well, you're certainly selling it as a holiday destination.
Beautiful.
Well, from the way you're talking, it sounds like, now correct me if I'm wrong, but I this is the picture I have in my mind of something like the opening scenes in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Is that right? Something, you know, there's those big landscape, steep-sided mountains with trees that just seem to be as dense as anything.
And why up above that, just the depth of the snow and just knowing that there's rock face that has not seen the sun for untold amounts of years because it just holds snow down there all year round. And one of the ranchers down there told a story. He has the Pisco Sour effect theory. And his theory is that it's staying so cold down there because much as you drop one ice cube into your cup of Pisco Sour, the pieces of Antarctica that are breaking off and the glaciers that go floating by are cooling the area. And that's his theory of why he can't grow strawberries or beans anymore. Because they can grow the plants, but the plants don't fruit. No dan fruta, they say. And every rancher we talk to and farmer could point to that has changed in the last 5 to 10 years. Every single one asked independently gave us the same time range of when they went from being able to grow their own food to losing some of the variety that appears on their dinner table.
Wow. Okay. You've painted a lovely picture of what the area was like when you first started. Now, the trails that you were following, are they a series of old, Inca trails or older trails that the earlier natives forged, which then became roads, a bit like I know you've been to the UK and you've been to, you've done Scotland, you've done the West Highland Way. You have footpaths and then you have drovers' roads, which are old ancient roads, which they'd used to drive the cattle through. So the I'm just trying to visualize that the trails that you set out on, if it was the highway or it was an ancient way of communicating between villages. Give me a bit of an idea. Try and sort of paint a picture for us.
That we started on? I would say that the routes that we started on down in south Patagonia were old, probably old, like either logging or farming roads were how they would get back to get their cattle. Most farmers or ranchers down there have, they ride horseback. They don't really drive. So some of them have four wheelers, but most of them will have these horse trails or cow paths that they follow. And so what Fidget or Bethany was talking about with the logs across the mud, those are more for four wheelers, ATVs. So they're only like 2 meters wide, maybe 6 feet wide. And so they just like, literally they'd probably just fall a tree and then just like go down next to the other trees. And then they would like bump their four wheelers over that. I wouldn't say a truck would be able to go over that.
Sorry to interrupt you, but the route that you were following then, were they a series of these horse trails or whatever all linked together? Did you know about them or did you have them on a map or was it local advice or what?
I had done some overview planning on Google Earth Pro. And then what we learned was, rather than telling people the scope of what we were trying to do, we would talk to the locals and we would just tell them the name of the next town. I had plotted out all of the towns I thought we'd stop through. I tell them the name of the next town. And then they'd be like, oh yeah, my grandpa used to run the sheep through, or there's this pass that everybody takes the cattle through. And so most often we were following those routes. And so we were always at an advantage. If they'd already moved the animals through, there was much less bush bashing because the animals would have done it. And I, having worked on a cattle ranch, have some experience with reading animal paths and knowing kind of, and so with those, we could piece that together. And then what it was interesting to then learn was that those routes pieced together essentially overlapped the route that the Tehuelche indigenous people of that area in the summer, they would walk up the mountains and then they would go down over to the eastern coast of Argentina and then walk down the coast in the winter. And once we started entering some more indigenous areas, they're like, yeah, this was, but they used like the mountains as their point of navigation, as opposed to the town stops like we do in the modern iteration of it. And so our route also took us past like the Cueva de Manos and like hand paintings and trees that had been like split in certain ways. So it was following what the ranchers had been doing, which had in turn followed what the indigenous people had been doing. And then that has been overlaid with what is now called the Greater Patagonia Trail, which is a series. It's a brand new, like basically still in process and very unofficial project of some friends of ours that we were able to contribute, that is creating essentially a network of routes and options for exploring Patagonia, whether by pack raft or on foot. And they have thousands and thousands of kilometers of route options. And we just kind of navigated those together and connected that up to Santiago, Chile. So our first season was a lot of deep back in the mountains, you know, sitting with a Mapungun matriarch who has her husband like cooking the piñon nuts for us while she wrangles the chicken and speaks to us half in her dialect, half in Spanish.
And so it must have been a fascinating experience then to actually realize you're on those historical paths and put your hands on those prints and those paintings that people probably have never seen from the Western world as such. I mean, the locals may recognize them as being there all the time. Like we have our standing stones here. We walk past them, drive past them, and we acknowledge them. But to see them fresh from your point of view must have been a lovely experience.
Mm-hmm. It was an eye-opening one talking to one gaucho, and he and I was just standing out in front of where he lived and was like, you're so lucky to live. Of course, this is all in Spanish, but I'm like, you're so lucky to live here. This is so beautiful. And he was like, it would look that way through your eyes because for you, it is a choice to be here. Mm. For me, I could not be anywhere else. You know, he talked about having a third grade education and, you know, he never had an option to be anywhere else. So when he pointed that out, the gauchos have this very gentle way of checking you really hard when you soar off into the
I've heard you mention the choice word a few times in previous interviews, and it certainly brings it home. You had a choice to do what you were doing. A lot of the people you were meeting, that was their life, and that was it, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Particularly even in Bolivia and Peru, that became very heavy there, because that's deep. You know, the people who live there are the direct descendants of the ancestors who live there. You know, I think Bolivia is 60% indigenous population. And by that point, we were on what's called the Capac Nian, which is the remains of the Incan highway. They had two highways, one that ran along the coast and one that ran through the mountains. And there it almost felt like, you know, I would ask the kids, I'd be like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And that was an utterly ridiculous question to them. They didn't have a choice in what they were gonna be. There was no idea of doing something other than what their parents did, which is the only thing that they feel that they can do, which is to raise alpacas and try to survive. And every single person who I talked to, you know, had a living memory of a sibling dying, of somebody being struck by lightning, of somebody drowning. They just say it so casually, then just the way that they relate to life and their visions of what of your mobility within that was so staggeringly ego checkingly different from what we're raised with.
Very sobering. Coming back to something you said earlier on about the safety aspect, and I don't really want to harbour on it too much because it's something that can be viewed different ways. These routes, as you were doing this over a period of weeks, months, I guess you'll tell me in a second, but what were you doing as regards accommodation? Were you accepting accommodation if some of the villagers offered it to you, or were you getting off the trail and camping wild in the mountains as out of sight? Well, how did you sort of approach that side of it? Because that's the big one that people probably would be concerned about.
It depended. It's actually really interesting because through a lot of the places that we traveled across South America, a lot of the men have actually gone into the cities to work. So it is mostly, especially in these like far back reaching areas, it's a lot of women that are just left with the children to care for the household. And so we would definitely... We carried a tent and we had our sleeping bags, and it would depend on how we felt. Again, we talked, Bethany already talked about how we would
have a safe word.
Yeah, a safe word. That's what we called it too. Mm-hmm. Talk about if we felt comfortable and like how we, if we didn't, obviously we would go out, like leave town and camp. But there have been times where we've asked, like we've walked into a shop in a small town, because shops are usually the shops in small towns are usually just like the front room of somebody's house. And so we'll like with shelves on it and like a few of everything, except sometimes cookies. So we would go in and we just like a lot of times it'd be like one of the older kids running the shop, and we'd go in and we'd be like, hi, is there a place to stay in town? Knowing that there wasn't on our map, but there could easily be somebody who would invite us in, or if they knew somebody who had an extra room. A lot of times if we were looking to stay in town, we would stay for a night and then head out again. We're not really looking for like a ton in our accommodations. It's just usually like a place to sleep. And if we were concerned that it was too close to other towns, then we would usually ask. And that's, being a woman actually helped us in a lot of ways with that, when we did end up in those small towns that were just full of women and children, because they don't really trust men.
Interesting.
There was this one town we hiked into right on the border of, I think it was Bolivia and Peru, and the town were acting really sketchy about us being there. And I was trying to read what was going on, but then I found out that it was like all of the adults of the entire village were going to leave the next morning at 2 a.m. to go to these unofficial border, like exchange markets where all of the Peruvians drive their trucks and all the Bolivians drive their trucks to this like little creek that like marks the border, and then they all like trade there. So they were nervous about having these two women who'd come flying in like on the front end of a thunder and lightning storm. And they were all going to be gone in the morning, leaving only their children and like two or three grandmothers who spoke only, I think that was an Aymara region. Oh. And so we woke up in the morning, and by the time we were done with breakfast, there's like eight kids crawling all over our backpacks and these like very skeptical, keeping their distance little grandmothers. And we walked out that day, and we accidentally walked into the trading that was going on just out in the middle of nowhere from miles and miles away. We could see that there was all of these vehicles, and we realized it's like this illegal trading
car boot sale.
Yeah. And I don't think they would have been comfortable leaving two strange white men alone with their children and their grandmothers. So
when you sign up for the Outdoor Station newsletter, you have the option to give us feedback on our shows. You also have the opportunity to suggest people of interest you would like to hear more about. You can also suggest UK campsites which you feel may be unique, and cottage manufacturers who would appreciate a little exposure to a wider audience.
The Outdoor Station. Sharing the passion, appreciation and understanding for the outdoors world.
I mean, it's a massive project, and obviously thousands of miles we're talking about, and there are so many stories, I'm sure. I suppose from a listener's point of view, I just want to dip into a few things, really. I'm guessing that when you first started and you packed your bag and you took your provisions and your emergency provisions and everything else you probably thought you might need, bearing in mind, obviously, you've got the sort of Triple Crown experience behind you, so you knew about packing light. Ultimately, as you went through all these different villages, and as much as they had their small shops and whatever, but I'm sure you must have picked up things from the locals that you went through, just ate what the locals ate and that kind of thing. So did you find it to be as big a problem resupplying and just having enough food to carry on that you anticipated?
I think it surprised me because my introduction to this sort of travel had been on long distance trails where there's an established community and you know what you're going to expect to find in the shops, and the shops know to have what it is that you're looking for. And to your question earlier, you know, the first part of it through Patagonia, we camped most nights. And then by the time we were getting up into Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, we were staying indoors most nights because that's just what was safer because the concentration of people was increasing. In the same way, it was interesting to track the change in the kinds of food. It's funny, each area had their own kind of food and their primary stimulant. So like through Argentina and Chile, the primary, like the basic food thing was generally white rice or flour. And then the stimulant was mate. And then once we got up into Bolivia and Peru and a little bit into Ecuador, the main food, at first it was quinoa, and then it was potatoes, and the stimulant was the coca leaf. And then once we got up into Colombia, I'd say probably the primary, and by Colombia, there's just so many people that we didn't actually pack a backpack. Like, you know, when we go out and we plan, you know, you fill your ruck with 7 days worth of food and you plan to be self-sufficient. Once we got into Ecuador, honestly, we were using a plastic Tupperware more often than we were our cook kits, because we would just go to these small towns and, you know, you would walk into these little shops, like Nan said, Lauren said, someone's front room and in Spanish would have the conversation of, is there lunch? Yes. Two. Excellent. And whatever comes out, whether it's alpaca kneecap or soup or fried chicken, Lauren's favorite, because that was all that there was for a long stretch for protein. That was almost all there was for a long stretch of Peru. It drove her crazy. But once we got up to Colombia, then the base of the food was often plátanos, bananas, plantains, and coffee was the stimulant.
So to answer the question then, once you got going, was it as big a problem to resupply, to feed yourself, as you initially may have anticipated, especially down south?
Not if we were willing to adapt to what was there. Down south, there was some component of trading, and also of their idea of hospitality is something quite different and something unlike what I've experienced in my other travels in the world. Like down there, it's the guest's responsibility to at some point say stop, because a person who lives out in the middle of nowhere with nothing or with very little would literally give you their last piece of bread. Like going up a mountain, there was an older gentleman coming down and he had these two beautiful wild hen eggs that he had gotten from a mountain hen. And I was like, those eggs are beautiful. And he was just immediately held out his hand and said, they're yours, take them. And I had to insist that no, like I knew this was this man's dinner and possibly his breakfast, but without question or without even what I considered a prompting, he was willing to give that and to go without. So we did learn in those southern stretches to accept kindness, because it'd be extremely rude to just outright say no, and also always carry gifts, because the mercantile trade is not something that's very comfortable for them, but gift giving and gift exchange is very important. So we learned to carry like sachets of juice mix and a couple of extra heads of garlic and oranges. If you can give fruit, oh, that is, you're really speaking care to each other. If someone gives you an orange or you give an orange, that is...
So what would you say that you've, I mean, you said at the beginning about going there to learn more and to understand the communities and understand the female way of life in a patriarchal society. What are the big things that you've come away with from the experience in South America, would you say?
For me, specifically in regard to the gender observations, is that the system is developed, has been built on a complicity that the women, many of the women are just as machista as the men. And also that while you may not see women leading, they are still running things. Like, for example, going into one of these small shops, it's going to be the man most likely who will come and speak to you. But if you ask him, how much does this item cost? He turns his head and looks to the back of the store where you may or may not see someone. But there is, more often than not, a woman sitting down behind the counter, and she'll tell him what the price is. And you have to pretend like you did not just hear her. And then he will repeat to you what it is that she has said. And you have to play this in between game. And it's there's that component of it that I found interesting. And family, care for family was very important. A lot of people, they'd ask to, you know, they'd be like, what's your name? And I'd be like, Bethany. And they're like, but what's your last name? And I didn't understand why that was so important. Then I realized it's because that's how they place one another. If they have a local name, that's how they, you know, they know what valley you're from. And that's their context for the world. So those have been a couple of my observations.
I think for me, I had never spent an extended period of time internationally. And so it just like threw me basically into this like completely unknown area, and like both culturally and like for me, it's I do better when I'm in the wilderness, to say the least. And so for me, it's like, okay, sweet, I can read these mountains. But then it helped me realize that like the people of the area are so integral to the natural parts of the area. And so traveling through these different areas, it's like you see the care that's taken to take care of the land, the different ways that people are learning and growing about like it's much more intertwined with where they are and where they're from. Like, she talks about last names, but there are also people in Peru who have literally lived in the same valley for like hundreds of years. Their family has lived there. And so we actually ran into these people who the valley has changed hands and been kind of taken over by the government, and they've still found this family. What is it, 5 generations of this family have still lived in this valley and found a way to make money, because at the beginning they were ranching and farming, and then the government decided that it was going to be a national park, so there were like some hot springs in the valley, so they decided to be the caretakers of that hot springs. And it was really cool to see the different ways that these just people are able to adapt and overcome, basically, even if something as big as the government comes in and like takes over, like, quote unquote, your valley, they can still find ways to make it work for them and take care of this land.
So the trails that you have been on in the various places, are you expecting them to become future long-distance hiking trails with your connections that you have done? And also, as part and parcel of that, did the indigenous people, did the local villages and communities, did they recognize that there was potentially a future business in the activity that you were doing? So, you know, were you seen initially, I'm guessing you were into a community, they had never seen, perhaps not seen white people before, but certainly not seen hikers, female hikers walking solo. And I'm sure as conversation evolved, you might have suggested that there could be a future in that?
Yeah, yes. That's a very astute question. With eyes first to sustainability on these things, I don't, and I hope that these areas will never see an influx of hikers, like, for example, the Pacific Crest Trail have, or at least not for quite some time, as it will take the people some time to adapt. It was kind of a funny observation I had of the generation before us. The people survived by herding animals through, and the people our age and younger had adapted to, they realized they aren't moving animals, but they can move tourists through. But whereas you could move like 200 to 500 cattle, you could maybe move like 5 to 10 tourist visitors. So there is in some areas a heavy, like, for example, in the Cusco region,
huge.
And around the parks in Chile, pretty much anywhere there's a park, there has arisen a culture around that. And there is a hope that the local people will see that by protecting their local environments promotes its beauty and thus can bring more opportunity to them. You know, some areas we walk through, we would joke, like, everybody's a tour guide. Like, you'd be walking past and there'd be a man working his field, and once you start talking to him, he's like, well, I'm a fishing guide. Like, and we're like, oh yeah? And he's like, yes, look, I have a fishing lure in my hat. And we're like, so those are the qualifications for you to be. And other areas, it is somewhat regulated of who can be that. But as I see those of us in the most privileged positions on the planet looking for ways to maybe slow down and to engage more directly, particularly those, for example, who already have Triple Crown, who have had that experience and then are looking for something, that next deeper level, that involves going out and finding the routes. And by nature, a route is not a trail that's easy to follow. It's what Lauren always calls a choose your own adventure. What's up, yep, that scree field type situation.
Has this been created by animals or by people? Mm-hmm. That was always a fun one, and especially in Patagonia, because there are routes that people have created, but they've just they overgrow so fast, mm-hmm, because stuff grows there just super fast in the summer. And then we'll get like, we'll be like, is that a cow field or is this a cow track or a people track? And then you like, she's good at seeing the cow tracks and I'm good at finding the people tracks. And so it'd be like looking for like a cut branch instead of a broken branch or like something like that.
Okay. Well, I mean, we've certainly covered a lot of areas here, and I want to go on to another range of topics sort of in our next section. But looking at this particular map that I can see in front of me of South America, is there a way that you could describe the better countries to walk through? Or is there, say, that, you know, Chile was really, really tough, or Argentina was really, really tough, or it was, you know, a generalization. I'm seeking a generalization for anybody tempted to do something like this through these areas. How would you describe the different sections in South America? And also, just to give people an idea, did you do that all as one thing, or have you broken that up into different lengths?
I'll start with the last part of that question. We broke South America up into three of what we call seasons. And the first season, I think, was about 5 or 6 months long. And that went from Ushuaia, Argentina, and it crisscrossed between Chile and Argentina because you can only be in one of those countries for about 3 months at a stretch. And we ended it at Bariloche, Argentina, because winter caught us there. Our next season was 13 months long, and we went from Bariloche, Argentina, again, back and forth between Chile and Argentina, into Bolivia, into Peru, and we stopped in the region of Cusco, Peru. And then our third season was 9 months, or possibly 9,000 months. And it went from there to Turbo, Colombia, and then we were trying to get on into Central America, and that's where we began to run into some new variety of challenges. If someone is looking at traveling into South America, there's a variety of ways to do it. I mean, we learned in some areas there's circuits that people will do, which involves, you know, taking buses and you hit the parks, and there's guides there for that, and they're equipped with the ability to speak different languages, and you can do overnights. If you're more of a do-it-yourself person, you will be coming up against, you know, in the areas where they're trying to build an industry based on tourism, you wanting to go by yourself, A, confuses them because they're much more like socially minded. So the fact that you want to do it by yourself is difficult and kind of offend them because you're not using their expertise. But if you're looking for more of that solitude experience, you're looking more at Chile and Argentina, which have the advantage of currently having more stable governments and infrastructure. There's also some very remote regions of Bolivia and Peru. Those are a little bit more, you know, if you're sticking to the salt flats again, or the Cusco region again, these are developed tourist areas where you can expect to be understood for what it is that you're looking for. It's when you wander outside of those regions that you're met with blank stares or sometimes gaping stares from every single person in town and screaming babies stop to stare at you or silent babies begin screaming when they see you. So it just depends on the area that you're going to and what it is you're looking for in that experience. For me, one of the most delightful surprises was actually Colombia. I had been fed a lot of fear over the years, and Colombians were so kind and have some true, they have glaciers. There's glaciers on mountains in Colombia. They're some of the last remaining, I think they call them tropical glaciers.
That's awesome.
They're very clearly just the final dregs of what were once mighty glaciers, but, the people there were very kind. I enjoyed the food, and just the all of the abundant plant life and the kinds of trees. Like sometimes I felt like I was on like the savanna of Africa, although I've never been to the savanna of Africa, but other times I'm like deep, we're deep in like jungle region. And you also have that option. You can go to be going to the austere, like into these places of the Andes where you're just in the land of the gods. And you know that as a human being, you're just lucky to be visiting, or you can be deep in the jungle in a cloud of butterflies. So whatever you're looking for, you can find it in South America, except maybe fast internet. If you really need fast internet, that's maybe not where you want to go.
Come to my place. Okay, so that's South America, and let's have a look at your other map that I've got here. Now, we've got chunks of United States that are in red and in orange. So you can give me a brief explanation of what they stand for. And then I sort of want to bring this first hour to a close, really, with where you're going to be heading, subject to COVID, obviously. Where are you going to be heading next and what the ultimate goal is?
So across the U.S., and it's so interesting because Fidget and I have been planning to split up for a while across the U.S. because we just had different ideas of what we wanted to do and trusted each other enough to know that we would do them. But I had already done the Continental Divide Trail, and so I wanted to do something different, and I was getting into biking, so I wanted a bike pack. And so the red line across the U.S. is Fidget. She through hiked the Continental Divide Trail from Montana south to New Mexico, to the Mexico border. And then the orange line is, I did a newly minted route called the Wild West Route, that goes from Canada to Mexico as well. I ended up missing a section 'cause I timed it poorly. But I'll be making that up soon. And across Utah and northern Arizona. But it was gorgeous. I rode my bike on mostly dirt track across four states.
And how did you find the traveling by bike, doing that particular trip down to Mexico, as comparing it to the South American experience as regards how you were received by people? Are we talking people were accepting that you were a, quote, tourist cycle traveler, or were you going through rural communities and experiencing warm welcomes?
In the U.S., I feel like people were pretty open and accepting. I was alone the whole time, so I didn't see anybody else biking, but I did see a lot of like dirt bikers and other people out there. And they were actually usually really kind. I had this one woman who was having a garage sale, and she kind of called me in because she had actually lived in South America for a while. Well, we didn't know this at the time, but she saw me biking past as like a solo woman, and it called me up and like offered me water and gave me some like snacks and stuff, even just like while she was having this garage sale. And then she told me like her whole story about like she actually lived in South America for a while and like knew a bunch of Spanish, and so like our worlds connected. And then another woman in Idaho, like I was biking the opposite direction as her, and she was like, hold on, can I get a photo of you? Because she saw like all the stuff on my bike and was like, oh, like, where are you going? And I told her, and then she lived like right near Darby, Montana, and she offered to give me a resupply so I didn't have to bike 20 miles one way out of my way to get a resupply in Darby. And so like we exchanged phone numbers, and she brought me food down to Darby and like on her motorcycle. And then, she was awesome. And there were a few other dudes, like even, there was an older man who stopped me, and he just wanted to know what I was doing and, wanted to make sure I was being careful, and told me where him and his wife lived. And Good.
Now on the Mexico part of the bike packing, we're on what's called the Baja Divide. And that is beginning to be kind of circling back to your earlier question, the locals are beginning to understand that as a source of income. I noticed that in the conversations that we would have with them, because they would always, they would talk about the bike packers and they would talk about the Baja Divide race. And that made it, that helped me understand these are their two, essentially their two sources of income from outside. So particularly along the Baja Divide, and also hallmark of people understand what's going on is we could find Snickers bars. if you're going into town and there are, there's no Snickers bars, they have no idea what you are. But if you can find Snickers, even if they're dusty in a cardboard box, you're like, all right, these people have an idea of what's afoot.
That's your definition of a town going places.
Yeah. Yeah. and then once we cross into mainland Mexico, there is some other cyclists have passed through there before. And so there is some awareness, of the industry of bike packing. But, when you wander away from that main highway, which is our primary goal is to be as far into the wilderness as we can safely be. There's some like, where did you come from? Which is delightful.
Okay, so let's wind this hour up then with a conclusion of what you intend to do next, COVID permitting, and where the journey will come to an end.
Okay,
everything's up in the air right now because of COVID.
At the moment of recording, we're kind of in a place in time where it's difficult, and I'm sure for more people than just us to make plans. Because things are so up in the air right now. We're in the United States of America and Canada is understandably holding their border closed to us. And the section of Central America that we have yet to do is continues to be volatile in light of COVID and a number of other matters ranging from earthquakes to protests.
To what? Hurricanes.
Yeah, hurricanes. Our objective is just to, as we can, clean up Central America and to connect our route from South America to what we've already done so far in North America. And then to Canada, the goal is, or the aim, I'm so excited, is to hike the Great Divide Trail. And then from there to connect to the Arctic watershed that magically begins all of 100 kilometers north of where the Great Divide Trail ends. And then in partnership with our partners at Track Kayaks to paddle the series of rivers, which then flows out to the Beaufort Sea. We had initially intended to cross over and to go towards Alaska. We're now realizing that with how narrow our weather window in those northern regions are, to add Alaska on would add an entire another year of waiting out seasons to add that. So right now we're more of looking at just paddling straight out and probably ending off of the northern coast of Canada rather than trying to divert to the west into Alaska. But generally what we've learned in this journey is, you know, you make your goals and you set your intentions and then you just have to be prepared to throw those out the window as the seasons and opportunity invite.
My thanks to Bethany and Lauren for taking the time to chat. It was an enjoyable evening of wide-ranging conversations about travel, life, death, and the universe. In part two, we discuss the apparent US preoccupation with trail names, personal safety, the impression social media is giving to the more established hiking trails like the AT, PCT and CDT, expectations and pressures from loved ones, and mental health. This is a self-funded project, remember, literally traversing the Americas on a shoestring. Please check out my show notes on theoutdoorstation.co.uk or on their website, her-odyssey.org, to find out more. You'll see the photos, hear more stories, and of course you'll find all the social media links. It's been a long one, but I do hope you've enjoyed it. Drop me a line or leave a comment somewhere if that's the case. Until next time, folks. Take care out there now that we've been set free in the wilds once again. and bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.